it's amazing how many people are bringing up McIntyre. You know, I am shocked every time I talk to somebody and they're like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm rereading After Virtue, or I'm reading, you know, another book by McIntyre or something like that. So I think you're definitely right. I think we've moved into a new political moment. You know, both the end of left populism and COVID, I think, have totally changed the kind of world we're in right now. And those of us who are serious about political thinking, I think, are no longer thinking in the mode that we were thinking from, you know, say 2013 to 2020, you know?
Yeah, no, I have this thing about when there's political activity to be had, you know, everyone's talking and thinking about politics, talking like just the terminology is like bases and movements and voting and elections and whatever. And then when there aren't any kind of prospects, which was like the case throughout the kind of 2000s and early 2010s, especially, you know, the thinking becomes much more like sociological or philosophical. And we're asking kind of these deep questions. And I think we're kind of back into that.
Yeah, definitely.
Milan ou Tripoli, Vilnius ou Benghazi, Paris, Moscou, on fait le bunga, bunga, Bangkok ou Bogota, Le Caire ou Jakarta.
Right, hello everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, welcome friends. This is Alex here in São Paulo, Brazil, as usual. I'm joined by George Hoare, fellow Bunga boy. Hello, George. I didn't say hi to you last time, so like, I'm very conscious of like being, hey, how's it going, man?
Oh, I'm great. Yeah, great, man. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, it really means a lot, so thank you. Thanks good, for not being good. Antisocial and just continuing with your monologue and introducing me.
Sociability is what this is all about today, and we're very happy to also welcome Dustin Dino Guastella, who's a research associate at the Center for Working Class Politics and a director of operations for Teamsters Local 623 in Philadelphia. Dino, it's actually probably pretty belated invitation to have you on BungaCast, but we're happy you're here now.
I'm happy to be here. I'm a fan of the show, and you know, I'm glad to talk with you guys.
So, you know, we're very happy to have you on, and this is also a Damage episode, an episode in partnership with Damage Magazine, a magazine that you've written for a while. And we're going to focus on one of your pieces in issue two, the second print issue of Damage Magazine, which is about drugs, liberalization, social breakdown, focused on Kensington, Pennsylvania, or Kensington, Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, which we're going to get to in just a second. But I wanted to, because most of our listeners aren't in the U.S., at least half of them aren't in North America, if you could tell us a little bit about the Teamsters, for people who aren't familiar with what that union is and who it represents.
Sure. So we like to say it's America's strongest union. We're one of the largest unions in North America, and we represent primarily drivers and warehouse workers, right? Truck drivers, warehouse workers, package drivers. The name Teamsters, our union was founded in, I think, 1903. The name Teamsters comes from the fact that back then, a person who drove a team of horses was called a Teamster. So once this became mechanized, the, you know, working class kind of ethos behind being a Teamster carried on. And so the name comes from driving a team of horses, even though for most of our history, almost all of our history, it has been driving mechanized vehicles. Right. So it's a very strong union. We are one of the few unions, I think, in North America that is not a part of the AFL-CIO. We left the AFL-CIO sometime in the late 90s, I think. And there's some talks about maybe rejoining the AFL-CIO, but we are an independent union in that sense. And as such, there's a lot of really interesting politics that goes on in the Teamsters. And some of your listeners may have been familiar with the almost strike that we had with UPS, which is our largest single employer, which would have shut down the American economy effectively. So it's a very powerful union. It's a very strong union, and it is a very blue collar union. It's not, not primarily white collar workers, primarily blue collar workers. So, I mean, any other questions you might have, I'll try to answer them. I'm not a Teamsters historian, but I do work for a local Teamsters union here in Philadelphia.
No, I mean, a very contemporary question, which is like, what are the stakes of being or not being affiliated with the AFL-CIO?
The stakes right now, I don't think, are particularly high. I think the choice to leave the AFL-CIO happened at a time when the labor movement was really trying to figure out how to organize, basically. At the time in the 90s, the Teamsters and a few other unions had effectively decided they were going to embark on very large, very expensive organizing campaigns to try to figure out how to break the, you know, deadlock of the fact that we are losing so many workers in the organized labor movement in America. And they formed a new labor association called Change to Win, which embarked on, you know, really ambitious campaigns to try to reorganize the American working class, right? Unfortunately, because so much of this stuff is structural and has to do with the, you know, economic makeup of the society and less to do with certain techniques or strategies in organizing, that effort did not yield the fruits that, you know, many of the unions were hoping it might yield. So we're still, you know, in the doldrums of organized workers. It continues to go down, and we're continuing to see a weakening of the labor movement here. So I think the stakes now are much lower than they were in the 90s, because I think there's a recognition both in the AFL-CIO and in the Teamsters and those other unions that had left the AFL-CIO that we're, you know, this isn't really just about what types of organizing drives you do. This is about a much larger challenge, which is, you know, what the actual structure of employment looks like in the United States. And for that, yeah, I think, you know, most of the labor unions are now in agreement, right? We need a fundamentally different kind of economy, and one that the federal government takes a much heavier hand in sort of steering.
Right, right. No, and I guess, you know, workers in logistics and transport have a leverage there still, which isn't available to other categories of workers, right? I mean, I guess that's something that you can still work with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the strike for manufacturing workers or for logistics workers is a really, really powerful tool. And these industries have they make a lot of money. They make a lot of profit, right? So you can extract a lot from these companies. It's much harder to do that for, you know, Starbucks baristas, right? Like, no matter how many of them get organized, they just are running up against the structural hurdle, which is each of these little shops doesn't really have a very high profit margin, you know, and there's not much for them to squeeze out of that stone. So I think it is a real challenge of having a service sector based economy and trying to do working class organizing, because there's just this inevitable wall you're going to run into, which is a structural problem, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that raises a whole bunch of fascinating questions about the degree to which workers fight for wages or more autonomy at work and whatever, which would be a fascinating discussion, but maybe for another time, because I guess we have to talk about one of the consequences of deindustrialization. So your piece in Damage, in the second print edition of Damage magazine, an excellent piece called Making the Present the Enemy of the Future, centers on Kensington, Philadelphia today. So maybe you could paint us a picture of what Kensington looks like for those who aren't familiar with it. You say that some people call it Zombieland. So
yeah.
And can I just throw in an additional question here? Is it always sunny there? I have to make that reference. Because this is, I think, for speaking on behalf of the non-Americans, this is one of the more well-known portrayals of Philadelphia, which feel free to say you never want to talk about it, because everyone's like, oh, Philadelphia,
no,
have you heard of that
great
show?
It's great.
Or if you actually like it.
It's a great show. And I can't believe it's still on the air. It's been ages.
How it hasn't been canceled or ran out of ideas. But yeah, so Kensington, this is, I guess, would Paddy's Pub be in Kensington, or would it be in a different area of
No, I think Paddy's Pub is in South Philly, which is near where I live.
Okay.
But Kensington, you know, there could be a Paddy's Pub in Kensington. At least there could have been several years ago. Kensington was historically the industrialized heart of Philadelphia. It was the most industrialized part of the city. At one time, there was something like 75 factories employing more than 100 workers just in that neighborhood alone. Since, obviously, the 1960s, that has been declining and declining and declining, and then really falls off a cliff in the 1990s when we start seeing the massive shedding of manufacturing jobs in that area. Now there are almost, as far as I can tell, I don't think there's a single working factory in the neighborhood. There are these big hulking remnants of what were once very large and active industrial plants. They now are just kind of sitting there empty, idle, and falling apart. The city has not been able to do much to attract investment into the neighborhood. And as a result, the neighborhood has fallen into the kind of void of what is Kensington today, right? Which is to say that it is the single largest open-air drug market in the city, and I think maybe on the East Coast. It is the place with the highest number of overdoses, the place with the highest number of shootings, the place with the highest number of homicides in the city of Philadelphia, which is an already fairly poor and violent city. So it gives you an idea of how much poorer and more violent the neighborhood is. And, you know, for my money, this is all a function of the tremendously destabilizing effects of just ripping the factories out of this neighborhood, which was once a very thriving working class area, and nothing going into that void. You know, it just everything got sucked into that economic void. And the result is what we see today.
There's a place in Kensington in London, which is in a very salubrious part in the southwest of London. So it's a bit of a bit jarring to read about Kenzo. It's like all these £3 million houses and the Natural History Museum. Anyway, sorry, Alex.
There's a story I think about American cities, which I think can be. People would be familiar with this idea, which is like, well, you had kind of great industrial cities. They went through a decline, particularly in the kind of urban core from the 1960s, 70s onwards. But then they kind of were reborn somehow with gentrification, hipsterization of neighborhoods and so on. And now, generally speaking, it's like the urban core is all kind of pretty and nice with like boutique shops and whatever. And then it's kind of poverty pushed increasingly to the outside. But I'm not sure if the story you tell about Kensington and about Philadelphia entirely fits that. So maybe you can set me straight.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that is correct. You know, many of the urban cores of, especially the East Coast cities in the United States, have been revitalized in a sense that, you know, many young people starting in the late 80s, going through the 90s, and especially in the early 2000s, started moving into these cities. Young artists, creative types, all of that kind of richer Florida idea started coming into the cities. The cities started becoming these hubs of these places. And then young professionals obviously started wanting to live in more walkable kind of social environments. And I do think this is a function of a kind of reaction to the intense antisociality of the suburbs and suburban life for young professionals, right? They were like, they're tired of that. They want to go where the action is. They want to live in a place that feels real, feels more real, you know? And Philadelphia definitely has that character in certain neighborhoods, especially the posher neighborhoods, right? What's interesting about Kensington is that it is butts right up against probably the most the poster child for this kind of effect, right? Fishtown is like the equivalent of our, you know, if you're familiar with Williamsburg, Brooklyn or something like that, you know,
right?
It's a formerly working class neighborhood that has just had this tremendous boon in restaurants and bars, and it's become a kind of amazing destination neighborhood. It's very, very expensive now. You know, it's, you know, people, houses are going for millions of dollars in Fishtown, which to, you know, friends of mine who grew up in that neighborhood think is absolutely insane, you know, thinking about what Fishtown was in the 1990s compared to what it is today. Well, Fishtown butts right up against Kensington. And so you can stumble out of a bar in Fishtown and find yourself on Kensington Avenue. And I think the, you know, juxtaposition of these two neighborhoods, you know, George, you were talking about Kensington, London and Kensington, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Kensington, London, it sounds like, is effectively right next door to Kensington, Philadelphia. It is a very posh neighborhood now. And it's very jarring to see the level of inequality and how, like, absolutely different it is between Fishtown and Kensington. And the plan, it seems like, is just let this naturally play out. The plan, I mean, from the developers, is to just kind of let this naturally play out until there's enough money in Fishtown to push out what's left of Kensington, you know?
Right. Yeah. And all that land would be devalorized, would be cheap to buy up and then redevelop, right? I guess that's the kind of play there.
That's the standard playbook. So just to kind of, because I think in the article you paint the picture really well of this, you know, zombie land, both because of the way the people are potentially leaning due to drugs they might have taken, looking like zombies, and also because it is a kind of an undead place in some ways, perhaps, speaking urbanly, if that's a word. But I guess just to link it back to the title of the second issue of Damage, which is Deinstitutionalized, features, you know, this sounds like an extended advert for Damage, but you know, I think it all goes together really well with this central idea of psychiatric deinstitutionalization, which is you know, a process which happened in the US and the UK. But I guess my question is, in this part of Philadelphia, what has been deinstitutionalized, or what is the institution or institutions that were there that aren't there now? I mean, it might be quite an obvious question, but it's good to just link it in there, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, being that it was the most industrialized part of the city, it was also probably among the most unionized parts of the city. And Kensington was famous for having very strong unions, tons and tons of little local unions, tons of union halls, lots of social clubs, lots of working class, you know, music halls, things like this. You can still see the remnants of this in Kensington. And I think with deindustrialization, all of those institutions, those kind of medium level civil society institutions, have disappeared. The other deinstitutionalization that I think is significant here is the United States has almost no way to deal with psychosis, public psychosis, or drug use, right? So the only institutional mechanism to deal with this is by locking people up effectively. There is no other way of saying, you know, we're going to get people help, we're going to, you know. And this came out of a process of deinstitutionalization in the 1960s, which had to do with kind of cleaning up the asylums. And the idea was it would be better to have these patients under community care, under the care of their own families, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was basically code for responsibilizing the public to deal with this problem without the state, right? And the state will just retreat entirely and kind of figure it out. Let's see how this plays out. And it's played out very badly. So I think there are two ways in which deinstitutionalization really has happened in Kensington. The first is getting rid of the institutions of civil society, the working class institutions of political leverage, and the social institutions that sort of made social life possible in the period of industrialization. And the second is the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill, which means that the state does not have any way to take care of, you know, psychosis, drug-induced psychosis or not. And everybody is just forced to rot in crummy jails if they're going to not rot on the street.
Yeah. No, I mean, it happened in the UK as well. Care in the community ended up being, you know, to oversimplify, a way for the state to kind of take a step back there. But you mentioned drugs a few times, and this is one of the main parts of the article or what you kind of explore, the Portugal solution or the Portugal approach. Is this a kind of non-institutional response to deinstitutionalization? I mean, am I putting that in needlessly complicated ways? Maybe actually what do they do in Portugal with drugs? Could you tell us?
What they were doing in Portugal, which seemed to have been working, was a mixture of needle exchanges, liberalization of, and by liberalization, I really mean the kind of softer touch about public drug use, instead of immediately locking people up, instead of arresting everybody, they were more willing to give fines for drug use. They were more willing to, so they kind of softened the state repressive apparatus, but they ramped up the state's care apparatus. So there was actually a pipeline to get people help. And for a long time, this model was working in Portugal, which was to say, you know, we are going to, we're going to get you help. But in the meantime, we're not going to, you know, slap you for drug use, right? It's a model that makes total sense. The problem is twofold. One, I think it unleashed a dynamic in which the handing out of the needles and the sort of relaxing of the social mores around drugs and social norms around drugs kind of greased the wheels for the drug market, right? Because now you have a kind of opening for this market to exist, right? Instead of it being a black market, it became a gray market, right? And whenever a market gets a chance to expand, it's going to expand to the greatest degree possible. And so I think it unleashed a dynamic where the drug market starts expanding. We see this in the statistics. There was a rise in hard drug use in Portugal throughout the period of, you know, the early period of the harm reduction stuff. And then what happens is the state's ability to care for these people starts to get very strained. So this is where the title of the article comes from, which is to say that you can say, if resources were not a problem, you can say this is a model that will work. But eventually, you're going to come up against the hard fact that by expanding the population of drug users and expanding the population of addicts, you are going to strain the possibility of rehabilitation for these things on the public purse, right? If the population just keeps expanding, the public are footing the bill, and eventually there's both a political and an economic imperative to say, we got to cut back, right? So what did Portugal do? They cut dramatically on the care side of things, but they kept in place the needle exchanges, the harm reduction, and all of the cheaper ways of dealing with the problem, which just exacerbated it. And the actual architect of this has said repeatedly that this is not, you cannot just decriminalize drugs and hand out needles and think this is going to solve the drug problem. It will make it worse. Despite the fact that he said this, Americans, I think Americans in particular, I'm sure it's happened elsewhere, but Americans in particular, you know, immediately ran with the decriminalization idea. And even though we have no public health mechanism to solve this, I mean, we don't even have a public health system. In Philadelphia, we don't even have a single public hospital. We have no real way to provide drug rehabilitation. So instead, what is happening here is people are saying, well, at least we can prevent people from overdosing. At least we can prevent people from contracting HIV. At least we can do these things. And I understand the impulse there, but I think many people underestimate the effect to which they're greasing the wheels of the drug market and speeding up, accelerating the ability for this market to sort of really get its hooks in that part of the city. And that's what's happened.
I think one of the, I mean, for many of us, you know, especially Gen X and millennials who grew up through the war on drugs and all the chaos that caused, that the default response was a libertarian one, right? That, well, people should be allowed to choose what they want to do as a kind of, as a sort of moral principle, and as a more consequential one, looking at the consequences of what the war on drugs has been, both in kind of across Latin America, but also at home in terms of the repression and the mass increase in mass incarceration, which has now finally kind of peaked and started to decline in the US. That given all that, you know, the response has to be legalized. And that was kind of a bit of a mantra, I think, for anybody kind of to slightly left of center across the board. And I think what's interesting now is we're in a historical moment, I think, where people are starting to go, well, you know, that's obviously not enough. That in fact, even state authorities have caught on to this more libertarian approach, as you indicate, and realize, well, actually, that isn't the solution that we thought it would be. we're in a weird halfway house where the war on drugs still kind of continues, albeit in a much more attenuated fashion. But at the same time, we don't really have a complete reorientation to how we might deal with this, with these problems.
Yeah. Sorry, just, and I think, just to jump in there quickly, because I think it comes through in the article that like the, it's almost like the mirror image. So the war on drugs is, you know, tough, being really, really tough on drugs. Well, what's the opposite of that? Because the war on drugs has failed so spectacularly, it must be just decriminalized. And I think what you show is that, you know, it just doesn't, it doesn't work. Like either both of those two responses, you know, they have almost kind of mirror image, although the article is not about the war on drugs, they have kind of mirror image problems. Like they don't deal with whatever is the cause of the drug problem. They try and answer it on its own terms. Anyway, I think it's just it's kind of a useful, like libertarian and kind of aggressive conservative responses don't really seem to work even on their own terms.
Well, and I think what's interesting about both of them is that they're both, no one ever talks about it in this way, but they're both fiscally cheap responses, right? Like people always forget that for a period, I think many people on the left thought, well, you know, this is so expensive. The war on drugs is just so expensive. No, it's actually much cheaper than fixing it the way that we want to fix it, right? Mm. Like a genuinely social democratic response to fixing the drug problem would require way more money than what the war on drugs required, because locking people up is way cheaper than reindustrializing, reorganizing your economy, and providing like a robust, you know, social safety net, or even a robust social system that can provide like the basic necessities of people, right?
Right, and I think it's useful that you say, you know, I want to highlight this, lest it gets kind of, you know, goes under the radar. But you know, the approach that we want, as you put it, it's not just more care for drug addicts, support, etc., help to get back into the job market and stuff like that. You're talking in a, you know, actually reindustrialization, offering jobs, a much broader kind of reform of society than just what is normally spoken about, you know, as the response, which is neither the libertarian nor the conservative one, which is like a little bit more care. And it's like what you're saying is not just the care stuff. It's not just the kind of soft support for those who fall through the net, but actually a much more important restructuring.
Right. And I think the challenge about this is you have to actually have, this goes back to what you were talking about before, Alex, about like the knee-jerk kind of legalize it, right? I think the knee-jerk legalize it response was a moral response to the war on drugs, seeing the war on drugs as being so bad, being like, well, you know, we have to go the other way with this. Unfortunately, I think the unexamined moral shift that happened there was by saying legalize it, you're also saying that drug use is effectively a moral neutral, right? And that the society should be effectively neutral on addiction. And it's up to the individual, it's up to their, you know, what they decide to do and how they decide to live their lives and all this kind of stuff. It's very libertarian. But it's also, I think, mistaken in that there's this idea that there is a set population of drug users, right? It's basically X percentage of the population, right? And if they want to use drugs, like let them do it, it's always going to be that percentage. What this misunderstands is that markets draw people in, right? They will pull people in to this thing. And drug markets especially do this because they actually have a physical, chemical thing that happens to your body that makes you want the drug.
And as social desperation increases, there'll be more, you know, there's the kind of a target market increases as well.
I was going to say, you have to have a moral argument to say, you know, we actually think drug use is bad for the society, you know, to the extent that it exists in America, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And two, how do we actually stop people from wanting to do drugs, right? Not how do we get people off once they're hooked, but how do we actually prevent the drivers of addiction? And I think if you agree with both of those things, you come to very different conclusions than the harm reduction people or the war on drugs people. You have a totally different way of thinking about the problem.
Right. And I mean, it's a testament to a change in social mores, because if we think about the way that advocates for liberalization spoke in the 80s and 90s, it was always perhaps overly defensively, like, we're not in favor of taking drugs. We're just saying that the whole war on drugs is terrible, right? Because of all its negative consequences, both at home and abroad, etc. And now it's slipped into a much more curiously enough, you know, much more like affirmative response, which is like, no, actually drugs are cool too. You like go ahead and do that. And so that defensiveness is gone. I think the lack of that defensiveness is merely a reflection of the fact that the authorities are more open to kind of liberalization. And then people feel like, well, actually, no, we can say that taking drugs are fine. There's an interesting analogy, I think, even with, and this is a real error that's made, even with sex work or with prostitution, as it was traditionally called, which is that there's an analogy made between kind of recreational drug use, you know, you choosing to do some lines of blow at the weekend, or a, you know, student or whoever deciding to make a little bit of extra money having an OnlyFans versus kind of street corner prostitution or the desperation of drug addicts with little else in their lives. And a kind of analogy that's made or an elision between those situations as if it's all the same. It's like, oh, well, it's empowering for me to do this, or it's liberating for me to do this. Therefore, this is something that can apply across society.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. Now you have professors at Ivy League schools, I think Ivy League anyway, doing heroin and saying, you know, it's no big deal. I guess like just this might be too much of a, like, I don't know, a philosophy of ethical philosophy or ethics point, but it does seem like we have lost that kind of I don't know, ability to criticize people's second order interests or second order. We're talking about McIntyre, and I know we're going to go on to talk about him again, and so this is right in the vaults of my kind of brain. But this idea that you, like, people might do drugs and that is okay, but people wanting to do drugs as an escape from society, that's something which we don't, as a, you know, collectively feel like we have the authority to comment on anymore. Like, we should not, I mean, maybe I'm kind of generalizing from my own preferences, but it seems like the situation where people feel like they want to turn to drugs, that's not something which a society in general should advocate or should be okay with. And we feel like that kind of moral, like, what is this society for? What are we doing collectively? That sort of position is a bit less common. But that's also kind of consistent with saying at the individual level, if people do drugs, that's not the, you know, that's not the end of the world. So I don't know if I made that clear. I need to swap up on my McIntyre or Charles Taylor. That might be, that just shows I should go and do some reading on that.
No, I think you're onto something, George. I mean, I think that there is America especially has a very libertarian political culture. And I think people feel very strongly that you shouldn't tell somebody what to do or what is good for them. Right. And I think on the left, that on the left, that manifests itself as, you know, both the libertarianism, but also the question about what is good for somebody is a real challenge for people on the left, right? Because we simultaneously believe that we have the right idea of a good society, right? But we don't have any conception, or at least we don't profess to have a conception about what it means to live a good life. And I think this is a contradiction that many people on the left do not realize or confront, because it's difficult to think about, right? Like, how do you have a society that says both we are going to be soft touch about drug use because we, you know, we're adults here, and also a society that says, no, addiction is actually a social problem, right? And I think it's much easier to resolve this contradiction by saying addiction isn't a social problem and it is a personal choice, than it is to resolve this contradiction by saying, no, actually, you need to have a much more equal society. You have to have a much more developed society. Because, you know, what you guys are both talking about is this weird thing, you know, the Ivy League professor who uses heroin on the weekends, he thinks, or at least he says in the New York Times, that this is fine, right? He obviously does not think, or shouldn't think, that walking up and down Kensington Avenue, things look fine. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
These are very different social worlds that these people are living in. And we're trying to make policy that satisfies both of them, instead of trying to make the social world the same for both groups of people and then have social policy follow suit from that. You know, it's very difficult to write laws that pertain to effectively upper middle class Ivy League professor, and then say, oh yeah, and all you people who are you know, very poor, struggling, and having a miserable time in Kensington, yeah, this applies to you too. You know, if you read the New York Times and it says, you know, doing heroin is just fine, it's a very different takeaway for somebody who hasn't had a job in 4 years versus somebody who is.
Yeah, thank you for making the point that I was trying to make, but much more clearly and articulately. That's very helpful for me.
Yeah, but there's even, like, you know, social psychological studies which demonstrate the extent to which, you know, having a stable kind of life is actually an impediment to addiction. You know, that you, like, you take two people or two kind of subjects in different situations, and one will get much more likely to be addicted than the other person will. So, I mean, this isn't even something which is kind of novel or contestable. I think, you know, it's fairly well established by now. So another notion that you bring in the article, which is worth dwelling on, is that of bare life. Now, regular listeners of BungaCast will know we discussed this notion quite a lot throughout the pandemic, because it was something that was often brought up about whether, you know, the organization of society or the running of society should be based around the idea that, well, the of a kind of bare minimum that we can agree to, and whether that is sufficient, and the way that that might be contrasted with a politics which pursues human flourishing. In fact, it was a critique of the pandemic that was made, or the way the pandemic was managed, particularly with lockdown, which was seen in a critique associated with Giorgio Agamben, but not limited to him, that saw the management of pandemic as saying, well, just keep people alive, but you might remove all the good things from life. And then there are serious questions to ask about kind of what is the good life? What are we trying to pursue here? And I think that this comes through kind of in an interesting way in your discussion of drug policy and social decline and its consequences, looking at Kensington specifically. And it seems like contemporary liberalism says, look, you can't have flourishing, or at any rate, we can't decide what the content of that flourishing would be. We can't make that statement for society. It falls down, you know, it comes down to individual members of people. And so the best we can do is just stop people from dying, stop people from being the worst. And also, if we pursue some idea of flourishing, some people might fall by the wayside because they might not conform to that, or they might even die. So best just, like, stick to the bare minimum. And what I like about the essay is that it actually shows that a policy of bare life, which you could characterize the kind of harm reduction drug policies of just needle exchanges and decriminalization as being, in a way, a politics of bare life. Like, just make sure people don't die from infected needles, and otherwise let them get up to their own devices, actually shows how close bare life and death actually are, right? Those are meant to be opposed, but actually shows, you know, with the kind of walking zombies of Kensington, or indeed what I see in the streets of São Paulo, that are actually kind of surprisingly close together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's striking to see. And when I was reading that Agamben stuff, I was really impressed by, you know, obviously much of this came out during the pandemic, but I was impressed by the fact that, you know, this model of governance now does seem to have expanded, right? Since the pandemic, I feel like this is kind of the way in which many people think the world ought to work, right? Somebody said, somebody emailed me, a friend of mine emailed me that in Seattle during the Chop Chaz thing that was happening during the pandemic over there, a friend of his who's a letter carrier, I think, works for the mail service here, said, you know, what are we doing? We're ending all life in the name of health. And I thought, you know, that's a really brilliant way of putting it. And I think the same is true for the way in which we think about harm reduction, or at least not harm reduction in the robust sense, in the sense of actually providing people with the tools they need to get clean, but harm reduction in the sense that we're just going to give out needles, we're just going to do these things to save lives. We are saving lives. And what's interesting is if you listen to these nonprofits that do this, they will insist over and over and over again. On one hand, they will say, first of all, we're not going to tell people who to get clean. I heard one of the leaders of one of these nonprofits, when asked about, like, are you, you know, promoting for people to get clean, you know, to get off of drugs? And she said, my friends aren't dirty. Like, it was a moral judgment to even say that, you know, getting getting people addiction help is actually a bad thing. And, you know, how dare you even suggest that they ought to get addiction help, which I thought was just a totally batshit insane thing to say. But it's especially insane when you think about the job that this person does, which is going around handing out hundreds of thousands of needles every day and saying that this is actually saving lives. It's a whole, I guess in a sense, you're saving a biological life from overdosing, but it's hardly, you're hardly playing any kind of savior in this role. You're abetting dependency, right? I think to a certain extent they're abetting dependency. And I think
just to jump in there on the kind of the, isn't that partly the logic of the NGO that they do want to abet dependency in order, because if they were to taking too moral a stance in terms of saying like, actually my job shouldn't exist because actually what I'm helping people to do is to not need me anymore, that's a kind of institutionally not very self-perpetuating logic. And instead it's better to say, well, actually, you know, it's good for me as the best possible situation as one of the people who runs one of these NGOs is that you have the whole of Philadelphia needing my help. I don't want to be too cynical, but that's, you know.
No, I have a real hunch. I don't know enough about the political economy of these organizations, but I have a real hunch that so much of what is driving this is how these organizations are funded, how they continue to get funding, and the personal motivations and ambitions of people who have careers wrapped up in this stuff, right? Like, it's very hard to get somebody who is the director of an NGO that's entire mission is harm reduction to have the perspective that actually this policy isn't working. You know, it's much easier to do that if these were public institutions that were run by the state, because then the polity can say, this policy isn't working, we're going to change things around. But when they're completely unrepresentative organizations that just sort of have these missions that they've given themselves, you know, how do you deal with that? And the government, I think, is incapable of dealing with it because they've effectively divested their interest in this to these NGOs, to these nonprofits. And they say, you guys are the experts, you figure it out. We have no, you know.
Yeah, we're not going to judge. It's whatever, yeah. You know, you're, yeah. I think that probably is right.
So maybe move on to another article of yours. I want to discuss kind of some general themes about it rather than to recap necessarily the content of the article. But this was, I think, a very widely shared piece from last year, came out almost a year ago, or already a year ago, called Anti-Social Socialism Club. And I kind of had a quick look on Twitter, searched who had shared it. I was like, oh, wow, literally everyone who I follow or who I respect or whatever had shared this article, and for good reason, because it's excellent. Also in Damage, came out March 2023. So in that, you explore kind of left, I guess, progressive anti-sociality, you know, people who call themselves socialists but have kind of removed the social aspect from that as much as possible, it seems.
So what? So they just call themselves ists?
Ists. Yeah, it's just ideology. It's pure ideology.
Thanks. Sniff. Thanks, Zizek.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to quote from, maybe if you want to comment on this, because I thought this was quite neatly put. A large chunk of our urban population now works from home and dines alone on a regular basis. Though they are always by themselves, they are almost never alone, always scrolling, clicking, tweeting, etc. Even the possibility of self-reflection, the one socially virtuous aspect of lonesomeness, has been foreclosed by the permanent presence of social media. I thought that was quite neat, but you're reflecting there not just on what maybe already be a bit of a hackneyed topic of kind of being alone on social media or together alone on social media, but of a wider antisociality. So maybe talk us through that.
Yeah, so I think what we've seen over the course of the last 50 years or so, you know, starting in the post-war era and accelerating since then, has been a retreat from the social, right? In all aspects, right? We've seen a retreat of socialism, right? The idea that we ought to solve problems through collective solutions and that the state ought to play a large role in that. We've seen the retreat of social organizations, right? Everybody has talked about the hollowing out of civil society, of the destruction of what were once robust social organizations. And I think we've seen now what we are experiencing, which is, you know, obviously we have no idea how deep this pit goes, but feels like very close to the bottom of this pit, which is the retreat of actual social relationships, right? Even in one's personal lives, sociality has been diminished, right? And so on each of these orders, we can see how the self has transformed, right? People spend, I think, less time with friends today, in person with friends today, than at any point in recorded modern history, which is just unheard of, given that we have the ability and the capacity to spend a lot of time with friends, right? Like it's probably easier now to actually ring up a friend and say, hey, let's get a beer or let's hang out. And yet it's happening less and less and less. And I think the retreat of all of these other forms of socialization is both the product of and the contributing factor for that, right? So my big hunch is, to put it in like a sentence, the ability for people to have friends is effectively the marker of whether or not a society is capable of implementing something like a powerful welfare state. Because the more friends that you're able to have, the more you're able to exercise a kind of social logic of collectiveness, right? And the more you talk about the world as a social place rather than as an individual atomized place. And we are now, I think, in the depths of antisociality where people do not have a sense of their shared social connectedness and dependence on others. People have the very opposite sense. And up and down the class ladder, you see this in very different ways. I mean, people who work from home at the, not the top, but in the professional class, you know, they spend so much of their time locked away. And it's ironic because many of them moved to big urban centers so that they could be a part of neighborhoods and live a kind of hustling, bustling life that they imagined was written about in like Jane Jacobs or something like that. And now they spend all their time on a laptop in their room and never go outside, right? That's one problem. There's no forced socialization at work for those people. So they're not like, hey, I have to make small talk with the guy at the water cooler about the 76ers game or something like that. That doesn't exist for them, right? They spend all of their time doing what they want to do for work and talking to who they want to talk to. And then on the lowest end of the class ladder, it's the insane increase in drug use and homicides, right? What is the most antisocial things you can do are, you know, completely separating yourself from the world and living in a world of utter drug dependency, or literally murdering people. And both of those things have gone through the roof. And I think all of this is a product of the weakness of our social life right now.
No, I think that's really well put. And this article clearly resonated with people. You know, Alex said, all, you know, everyone that he respected shared it. So if you did read it and didn't share it, then you've gone down in Alex's estimation.
I'm not sure the whole logic follows.
maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. But no, I just wanted to, I think, yeah, I think it's a really great article. If I had been on Twitter, I would have shared it just to make that clear. Anyway, I'll stop digging myself into that particular hole. But it just really made me think at the moment, there's been a couple of books come out recently on, I guess, like how would you put it, like the mental health epidemic amongst children in the US and the UK. And yeah, I think the general diagnosis is that this, you know, it may be, and I think you definitely, you know, characterize this well or describe this really accurately, that there are people who call themselves socialists who seem to be antisocial. But more than that, it seems to be a whole generation that we're potentially raising in quite an antisocial way. So we have these ideas of, you know, might be put under the banner of safetyism. So kind of anything which involves social interactions face to face, particularly, or leaving the house, any kind of like physical danger, that's really, really, you know, verboten, you might say. And then at the same time, we have a kind of the perceived risks of the online world are massively exaggerated because, you know, you can have somebody tweet something bad at you, but that's not the, you know, that's a certain sort of harm, but it's not the only sort of harm. And so the end result of this is that children spend much less time with their peers. The average age, I think, in the US of a child getting a smartphone is 10. I guess it seems like there has been a qualitative change recently,
and we're sort of seeing how that's playing out. And obviously all of these moral panics about the next generation are really like, that's us. We're projecting our own failures as adults potentially onto young people and then blaming them in many cases. So I don't know if I really have a point here other than to say, I think this kind of the objective social breakdown is it seems to me to be real, and all the signs at the moment seem to suggest that it's going to get worse, because that is the sort of, you know, that those sorts of young people that we're raising because of our own anxieties, our own kind of instincts towards kind of turning inwards rather than making friends and touching grass or whatever people would say. I mean, is there anything we can do about this? It seems like there is a movement towards, I guess, kind of, you know, banning smartphones in schools or amongst young people. But it seems like I don't want to kind of relate it too much to the previous article, but it seems like that is one of the things which is causing a lot of harm. But it's a deeper problem, ultimately, as I think you kind of detail in the article. It's not that the individual things that people assign blame to or causation to are the things which are the problem, e.g. drugs. It's really there's a deeper, worse problem. I don't know if I really have a question other than to say it really struck me on rereading this article a year later that it's completely, you know, this is what everyone's talking about at the moment around young people.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. I think it'd be very good for the public schools to say you can't have a smartphone in school. I think it'd probably be really salutary for education if that were the case. But it's a small measure compared to what I think is really needed, yeah. Right? And I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like everything else we talk about, which is that we need, one, a public philosophy that says, yeah, actually, sociality is something we're going to fight for. We're going to fight to build up a strong civil society. We're going to fight to, you know, have people get out of their homes instead of watching, TV every night and scrolling on their phones every day, but actually spend time with other people, right? And for that politics to express itself, for that kind of public philosophy to express itself, you also need a government that is robust enough, strong enough, and willing enough to take on the masters of the markets, right? Because these are all things that make money. It's very hard to tell. I mean, I can't imagine the United States government going to its big tech sector and saying, shove off, you know, and we're tired of you. It's a completely impossible thing to even consider.
Yeah, or we're going to wall off all these areas of social life from profitability. Like, okay, go, yeah, if you want to sell toys to people, whatever, fine, you know, but all, you know, you're not going to have, you know, mobile phones in schools, for example, or whatever.
Right. So it's really tough. And I think both of these things are things that we need. We need one. And I'm actually heartened to see so many people are interested in this, because I do think it's going to be the challenge of our political moment. We need a public philosophy that says, no, sociability, sociality, these are good things. And these are things that we have to fight for. And we took it for granted that they were just natural things, that like human beings just do this all the time. And in fact, they're not as natural as we thought. They are environmentally produced, right? The level of sociability is a reflection of the society itself. And, you know, somebody in the 1960s who was a part of a bowling league, a union, and, you know, a church fundamentally had a higher level of sociability than the average millennial today, and certainly than the average general Gen Z person today, right? Who have a very weak sense of those things. And I'll also say this, you know, it occurred to me, Alex, when you were talking about this, that one of the reasons I think our generation, millennial generation, is thinking about this stuff, and, you know, I hate generation, I'm using generations as a shorthand, but
yeah,
to the extent that we actually took this for granted was the left populist moment, right? Many of us found ourselves in movements and in organizations that were growing and dynamic, meeting lots of people through that kind of political moment. And it sounds really corny. I know you guys probably remember this, but there was a long time ago, people used to joke about, well, it's really about the friends we met along the way. But there's some truth to that. I do think that the left populist moment provided a kind of haven for a lot of us. And once that era ended, we now look at the young people who are coming up behind us and we're like, they don't have anything like that. They don't have any political hope whatsoever. There's nothing that's giving them like, oh, well, maybe, you know, we can do something to fix things, and they don't have any organizational, institutional, social project that they're embarking on. You know what I mean? It's
right.
It's very bleak for them. And I think that's one reason why we are so aware of what's happening to the rising youths.
Well, I mean, there's another phenomenon insofar as people have friends, that people increasingly only have friends with whom they kind of see eye to eye to politically or in terms of quote unquote values, which is itself problematic. I mean, it's also good to have friends with people from different walks of life or different outlooks on things.
George. I mean, everyone online has, you know, friends who are politically different, but I can disagree with them, but we're still friends, or that kind of thing. Anyway, but I did actually just want to go back to something you said that I found really striking. This idea of a kind of public philosophy of sociality was one of the ways that you characterized it. What are the sources of this? Because this is something I guess I've been thinking about a little bit as well, that like there isn't. Do you go back to kind of the communitarians, like, you know, I mentioned Charles Taylor earlier, is this a kind of Christopher Lash? I mean, where is this kind of, is it in kind of culturally conservative critics where you can find this kind of, I don't know what it exactly is that you're kind of, or that we'd be looking for here. Is it a defense or an assumption of the good of kind of not being atomized? This is I do remember this, at least this is a Charles Taylor idea of atomization. That's the liberal subject is fundamentally kind of on their own and atomized from others. But yeah, I mean, is there anything that you kind of feel yourself drawn towards in this sense? Because it seems to me like the way you said it out, like, yeah, this is one thing that's missing, is that theorization or that kind of common sense almost of like, why is it good to be in a society?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the question, right? Like what is it about society that makes it an advantage? Right.
Yeah.
And I think we do need to theorize about it. In terms of who to look to, I mean, I think this is partly the challenge, right? I've always found Christopher Lash very interesting, but really underwhelming when it comes to actual solutions for this kind of stuff. The communitarians and the cultural conservatives are the same, right? They have a lot of really interesting critiques of liberalism. They throw a lot of really good bombs at liberalism and at individualism. But in terms of how to fix the problems, their solutions seem laughably unambitious, right? Like a return to the family or a return to an era which cannot be resurrected just seems, you know, both impossible and kind of silly after trying to take on such big problems as liberalism and individualism. To say, well, the solution is to do some community gardening just feels really
right.
Remarkably underwhelming. And so I do think that there needs to be, I mean, I'm a fan of the state. I'm a very big fan of kind of bringing socialism back into the conversation. But I think what we need is a revisiting of why it is somebody like Marx was so interested in the social question to begin with, why it is that in the period of really strong liberal individualism, all of socialism basically gets its footing, right? I mean, this is the period of the dominance of liberal social theory, and it's when socialism basically takes root as a political philosophy. If that is true, if that's the case, there's something there that they were looking at in the liberalism of their own times, in the atomization of their own times, in the public philosophy of individualism of their own times.
Right. I mean, well, to pull at this historical thread, I think we're now in a kind of perplexing historical moment. I mean, for obviously a huge number of reasons, but specifically with regard to this notion of, you know, to be on the left, to be a Marxist, whatever, on the radical left, and to approach society as something that needs to be reconstructed. Because that was never how Marxists saw their own politics. There was never kind of like job to tend to society. You know, in fact, if anything, that's a kind of conservative notion at best. And I don't think, you know, looking back from the history of the New Left, and even before that, whether that the social liberalism of the left was an error, but I think it presumed either the kind of perpetuation of the kind of social structures which perpetuated a certain sociality, right, that allowed for that of kind of the, you know, thickness of networks and people bowling together, not bowling alone, which then disappeared. And so that puts us in a weird situation, because I think a lot of the politics is premised on a different type of society, one society that doesn't exist anymore. So do we then have to set ourselves the task of reconstructing sociability, right? Which I think is kind of what we're skirting around here. And I don't really have an answer to that, because I think we're not even in a position to get very much done politically at all, let alone try to, you know, kind of rebuild society. So I wanted to kind of, as a way of discussing kind of issues of security, perhaps, maybe, and precarity, because in the article, about the kind of antisocial left, you write that, you know, Baltimore and St. Louis boasted murder rates that rivaled favelas in Brazil and cartel war zones in Mexico. And Slavoj Žižek wrote last year in the New Statesman, if the left disregards public safety, it is conceding to the enemy an important domain of dissatisfaction that in a time of anarchy pushes people to the right. Now, I don't want to necessarily get into crime specifically, but I think it's one of the areas, and this is very evident to me in Brazil, that the left has no answer to, and that increasingly there's a sense of like the left needs to have an answer to it, but isn't developing one. But you know, across Latin America, as crime increases and insecurity increases, and it's an insecurity in terms of violence and crime, which compounds a sense of insecurity, which is derived from increasing precaritization, the informalization of the economy, that creates a social conditions which create a demand politically for a politics which like the left is not interested in offering and cannot respond to, and maybe shouldn't try to respond to. I mean, it's certainly in terms of like, you know, authoritarian law and order policies, which aren't effective anyway, even on their own terms of resolving politics. I mean, I can refer listeners to the episode we did about Bukele in El Salvador, who takes these things to the furthest extreme. But, you know, where that sense of insecurity, the failure of development, etc., which, okay, you can say, well, that's Latin America, but increasingly is the case in you know, Western, you know, most advanced societies. And your depiction of Kensington, Philadelphia is, you know, as I say, not very far away from depictions of the peripheries of Brazilian cities, for example, or indeed the centers of Brazilian cities. So what I want to get to, I mean, as kind of winding my way to a question, is that, you know, how do we... What is a left politics which kind of responds to people's sense of or need for security? You know, I think that's a question which, again, is something that the left has never really had to think about or answer.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think to a certain extent, it actually does involve policing, right? And I think this is one of the things that many people are on the left are a little bit afraid of, because they are thinking of the Bukele example or really extreme examples of overbearing policing. But I'm not convinced, in the sense that I think policing have to be a part of it. And in fact, I think that there's an argument to be made that we need both more policing and better policing, and that this is a humane way to prevent crime, right? It's a humane way to sort of restore a sense of stability in neighborhoods that are ravaged by crime. And a simple way to think about that is, again, if you go back to the 1960s, if you look at old photos of a place like Philadelphia, for instance, in the 1960s, inevitably, if you look at some of these photos, you will see one or two cops walking the beat, just walking around a neighborhood. You know what I mean? This doesn't exist anymore. I mean, cops are in cars. They drive around in single cop cars, and they don't have a human presence in neighborhoods, right? But this is the kind of thing that, again, if we were to have a more public understanding of the issue of crime, as in that it is a public issue and it's an issue that we need to solve together, we would be completely comfortable saying, no, we actually do need to have more of these cops on the beat, demonstrating that, you know, they're there to prevent crimes and that they're there to maintain a level of social stability, and that they're ordinary people that you know and that exist in your neighborhood and that are just the, you know, the guy who pops in to the bar to see if everybody's okay. You know, that to me is needed. But the challenge is, I think, a political one, which is that people on the far left are very anti-police, right? The center left is not interested in spending a lot of money, and this would be a massive jobs program, right? We're talking about hiring, you know, hundreds of thousands of police officers in the United States. It would cost a lot of money. Police officers have unions, they have pensions, they have good health and welfare programs. You'd have to pay for all of that. So it's a very expensive program. And it's not appealing. And for the far right, I think they have a military idea, right? Like they want uniformed soldiers walking the street and with guns to like deter people from this sort of stuff. So I actually do think there is a way in which there could be a social democratic or left-wing response that is both humane and takes into account the challenges of policing today, but does not shy away from the fact that, in fact, it is needed. It is a good, it is a public good, and that it shouldn't be something that we leave to either private security, which is, I think, increasingly happening in major cities in the United States, let it get so bad that a Bukele situation happens and they just send in the National Guard everywhere to restore order, you know?
I mean, George, you know, this was kind of done in the UK, wasn't it? I mean, not with any great success in terms of community police support officers, right? I mean, that's kind of the model, yeah, of these sort of semi-cops who are just around and are mostly useless.
I think I thought actually the way that you were describing it, Dino, it seemed more like a kind of a Brazilianization. Like this is where we're heading. That Alex, you're right. Like these kind of community policing support officers, I think there's some variety of those words in some order. They haven't really worked, and that is because the authority. I guess two things have happened. One, the authority of the police has been very questioned and probably collapsed in the last 5-10 years. And secondly, all of the kind of the social, like pre-policing, I don't know how exactly you'd put it, but like enforcement of social norms, that becomes more difficult the less kind of dense social interactions are. So you do have these kind of people then who come in without really any authority to impose laws, which everybody gives themselves already special license to go around. So it doesn't really work. What's the solution to that situation? Well, it seems like one is to pay a private police force to kind of, I don't know, have some outsourced coercive power of some sort to solve some defined problems, but it doesn't really, that's not a social response. That is a completely withdrawn, individualized one. So yeah, I mean, it's a question that I've said this on the podcast before. I watch my kind of favorite go-to genre of TV shows is detectives and kind of cops and all this sort of thing. And even there you see the kind of cultural, I don't know, there's still going to be, you know, people like these crime shows, but the, I don't know, the kind of cultural authority of the police is, it seems to me, been very, very severely questioned. So it requires a rebuilding of some sort. The main characters in these shows that I watch are, they've always been troubled or had their own kind of things which they need to work through, but now the institutions themselves are seen as very questionable. So, you know, I guess it all returns maybe to the same sort of set of questions, which is how do you, and it's probably not an intellectual, but it's a practical task of some sort. How do you kind of reestablish the preconditions of anything resembling socialism in a kind of working society, which is no easy feat.
I mean, ultimately you come down to, I think, back to a political question, which is that of limiting markets and including criminal markets. And that, you know, obviously that again is itself question begging, but I think, you know, that would remain the kind of political objective and the way of thinking about it. Now, I wanted to move just on to maybe finish up and to talk about something we mentioned already at the start. This refers to an article which you've just written for Jacobin, Christianity, Morality, and Socialism. In it, you know, and maybe this is like too on brand for me to pull out as a quote, but here we go. Silvio Berlusconi remade the entire country in a mold that could hardly be described by anyone's conception as moral. Communism fell and then Catholicism. Today, no one believes in much. And that story obviously is dear to our hearts here, but I think is, you know, the Italian example is great because it captures something, I think, in very crystalline form, which is the breakdown of, you know, ideologies which really stood opposed in terms of conservatism and socialism or communism, but which shared a certain presumption of, you know, social thickness, of certain mores, etc., in favor. And the winner, kind of the horse which rides up through the middle of them and actually ends up winning, is the horse of individualism and consumerism and atomization, which is a horse that the world spirit Silvio Berlusconi rides in on. That was good. I didn't mean to go there, but that, yeah, that worked in the end, I think. Yeah.
That's the great horse. He's a horseman. He's
So you in the article point us, I think, to the work of Alistair MacIntyre, who was a Marxist, or, you know, I think he was a Catholic and then a Marxist and then a Catholic again, and is a very interesting theorist, which I think we've kind of mooted the idea of maybe doing that for the Reading Club. So listeners, let us know, actually, if this is of interest to you. Maybe we will do this in the latter part of the year or next year. But, you know, I guess you make the argument that I think maybe without that kind of Christian basis behind socialism, which many socialist thinkers didn't even acknowledge, but which was there as a sort of ethical background, things kind of end up a little bit all at sea. What's your take on this?
Yeah, so I think that to a certain extent, when you're rethinking these questions, and we had talked earlier about the fact that we're in a new political moment and a lot of questions that seemed settled are being rethought, right? And those are questions not so much about tactics and strategy, but much more about, well, what are what is the real basis for our political thought, you know, for a politically left-wing project? What does it even mean? What is, you know, how do we get to a place where we can think about socialism again? And so for me, that rethinking brought me back to, you know, the classic questions of like, well, what is it about a society that I think is working that provides for people's well-being, and not just their animal well-being, but also their social well-being? Like, really, not the bare life of Giorgio Agamben, where it's like, well, they're fed and they have a house, but a much thicker life of enjoyment and pleasure, and also of discipline and work and, you know, striving for excellence. These are things that make human beings actually enjoy their lives, right? And I started to think about the fact that I think many people on the right and on the left have a conception of politics that is devoid of that model, right? Like, of what they want to see in the human life, what the human life can achieve in its short, very short time on Earth. And for the left, I think much of what we've seen socialism transform into is a kind of welfareism, a kind of careism, which is constantly trying to mitigate the worst effects of capitalism, often in ways that I don't agree with, because I think they don't have a conception of what they think the good life might be, or what it takes for human flourishing. And so you guys have talked about this a lot, but, you know, UBI and things like this are a perfect example of this, where there's no moral philosophy behind this idea, right? The idea is simply that, well, we can just give people money, and work kind of sucks, so we ought to just give people money. And there's no thinking about, like, well, have you ever actually talked to somebody who's unemployed? they have a pretty rough go of it, you know? And the response to that is, well, we'll just give them more money. That's, well, I think there's something missing in people's lives if they don't have something to work for, to work toward, to work, people to work with, you know? Work serves a very important function in people's ordinary lives. And so this started, the UBI question is one example, but there are a million examples of, I think, solutions proffered by people who do think of themselves as socialists that take us down a road of actually kind of exacerbating the social conditions that they are trying to combat, right? And so I racking my brain to figure out, well, what are the first principles that would make some sense? And it turns out Alistair MacIntyre had the exact same crisis, and he had it during reckoning with the New Left, right? In the 1960s, he was a Trotskyist, and or actually, I think in the 1950s, he was a Trotskyist. And in the rise of the New Left, he saw these kind of fractures and splits and interesting developments that he thought were missing the mark, right, on some big questions. And so he writes this great little essay called Notes from the Moral Wilderness, where he talks about Stalinism and he talks about the New Left and he talks about sort of a kind of moral listlessness that he feels on the left, drawn to leftism, obviously drawn to socialism for very moral reasons, and then winding up in a period where he feels that morality has kind of flown the coop among those who think of themselves as socialists. And from that point on, he's really interested in rebuilding a moral philosophy. And he writes this book, Marxism and Christianity, which is also excellent, where he talks about the similarities between the philosophy of Marxism and not just the sort of gloss that I gave, which was the kind of cultural and ideological influence that Christianity had on Marxism, but a much deeper understanding of why these two philosophies are very similar and why they're both very successful as philosophies that attract people, you know. And then later he writes After Virtue. And then after that, Dependent Rational Animals. And most recently, Ethics and the Conflicts of Modernity. But all of these are dealing with the same problem, which is, can we have a human life that flourishes, that respects sort of virtue? And, you know, we can get into all of that. But, and a social life that is modern, right? Like, is it possible to have human flourishing under modernity? And I think this is the challenge, because on the one hand, it is impossible to imagine human flourishing on a large scale without modernity, right? And on the other hand, many of the symptoms of modernity are the very things that make it very hard for us to have kind of genuine community, thick social networks, thick bonds, and all of this. So for me, that it rekindles the idea that, you know, we do need socialism, and we need a socialism that is somewhat virtuous. And that was kind of the impetus for writing that essay, which came out on Easter. I was very glad that Jacobin published it on Easter. I thought that was fitting.
Excellent. I agree with a lot of that. And I think it's important to say that these questions aren't secondary. I think generally how it's treated is that, well, we can barely get welfare, so let's get that, and then we can look at these higher order goods. And actually, these are kind of first principles and fundamental questions of philosophy, of where we're headed, of what our aim should be, which would structure all the rest of the politics. So it might be, I think it's worth rethinking these things from the ground up. These things are the kind of primary questions. And then we can move on from there to towards politics, rather than just saying, well, let's have this politics of welfareism, and then we can start thinking about flourishing or whatever you might want. And I think you put that very well. I think we'll leave that there, because there's more to talk about, and we can do this at another time. But thanks very much, Dino. This has been fantastic. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. Great talking to you.